You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Waj.
Hey, how's it going? Robert, very exotic name you have, so I'm going to call you Bob, if you don't mind.
Not as exotic as yours. You can call me Bob, but your full name is, tell me how I do here.
Wajahat Ali. It's
like a katana. Wajahat Ali.
Yeah, it's like a katana. Just put it in the gut and twist it.
Okay, I'll remember that every time I pronounce your name. Thanks.
Just to make it memorable.
That'll come to mind every time. Wajahat Ali, but I will call you Waj for short. Is it Waj or Waj?
Wait, do you hear that? Whoops. Sorry. Sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah. Did you hear that weird CNN clip that started going off for no reason? My bad.
No, I don't think I did. Would you like to recapitulate it for our home audience?
Yeah, no, it's fine. Okay. It was about the White House iftar, and it started just playing, and I'm like, oh, it's about Trump's White House iftar, which apparently has very few Muslims.
An iftar so like no other White House.
An iftar, yeah. I think there's going to be pork chops and bacon served, so yeah. It'll be fun.
So let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is a Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are, as I said, Wajahat Ali.
Very well done.
And you are a writer, playwright, I think, and a lawyer.
I wrote and produced and published a play a long time ago, my friend.
Well, then you are a playwright for now and forever.
Awesome.
And you also were the lead author on a report that I remember well called Fear, Inc., as in Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America, which made a splash about, I don't know, what, 7 or 8 years ago?
Yeah, it was right around the time that Anders Breivik, the mass shooter in Norway, killed more than 70 people. And unfortunately for the timing, it came out right around the same time. And in his 1,500-page manifesto, he cited the ideology and writings and blogs of nearly every single person that we mentioned in that report. Fast forward 7 years, Bob, and every single person in that report is literally one step removed from the White House.
Really? Does that include Fred Flights, the most recent addition to the White House staff?
Center for Security Policy, right? All these people, if you look at John Bolton, our third NSA National Security Advisor, the person who he poached was a member of Center for Security Policy, a think tank started by Frank Gaffney, one of the leading Islamophobes who has emerged in the past 10 years. And Frank Gaffney teamed up with Kellyanne Conway for that bunk poll that Donald Trump then used to promote his Muslim ban, which became a signature policy initiative for him. And then, you know, Act for America, the leading anti-Muslim grassroots hate group, again, has given awards to many of the people, such as Mike Pompeo. There's Jeff Sessions, who's aligned with these folks. So it's pretty scary. And Jeff Sessions also, David Horowitz. It came up in his testimony, and he praised David Horowitz, another person mentioned in Fear, Inc. So literally every single major player that we mentioned in Fear, Inc. 7 years ago is now one step removed away from the major players in Trump's White House. That should be a little bit sobering for us.
Huh. So in some cases, these are people. In some cases, they're institutions. In some cases, they're both.
So it's like, very incestuous, very interconnected.
So like Fred Flights, a guy I mentioned him because John Bolton just hired him days ago as his chief of staff. And he was a senior vice president at this Frank Gaffney think tank you mentioned, which is very conspiracy theoretical, if that's the term. Sees dangerous Muslims everywhere they look.
Yeah, every moderate Muslim is a potential dangerous Muslim.
Right. Certainly, including you, since you wrote that report.
Yeah, but I shaved for you today for your viewers because to look less threatening.
Yeah, I would not have guessed. I would not have guessed you were radical.
I look like a nice Uber driver or the guy who does tech support,
or both. So now this leads us to actually, it may seem ironic in light of everything we've just said, but we're going to talk today about a controversy you find yourself embroiled in. Where you have wound up getting blowback from some Muslims, and you were disinvited. I don't know if it's to or from when you're disinvited, but anyway, your invitation to the conference of the Islamic Society of North America was withdrawn.
Yeah.
The annual conference. This seems to have had mainly to do with a piece you wrote in The Atlantic about Israel-Palestine and your trip to Israel. So we're going to talk about all of this, including Israel-Palestine. I maybe I'm doing us a disservice by not having someone here who is among the people who've criticized you for this. To some extent, maybe I can stand in and recapitulate some of their arguments as I understand them and be devil's advocate. And you're,
right.
I'm sure, familiar with their arguments. But why don't we start with the peace itself? I mean, that is the main issue, right?
So this started, I'll take the DeLorean to where it began and connect the dots.
Okay.
About 5 years ago, Shalom Hartman Institute, which is a well-known, respected educational institution with a footprint in Jerusalem and in New York, which teaches literally anyone about Judaism, Jews, Israel, and Zionism, and how it is debated in modern Jewry. They have this program called RLI and CLI, Christian Leadership Initiative and Rabbi Leadership Initiative, where they open up their playbooks to Christian American leaders, our students of leadership, and Jewish American leaders to come either to New York or also in their Jerusalem chapter to learn. One of the individuals who came for a conference one time was Abdullah Antepli. He's a friend of mine. At that time, he was an imam and chaplain at Duke University. Since then, he's become like the director of Muslim affairs. And he was really impressed with their scholarship. And he said, look, I'm seeing something called CLI here on campus. How come you guys don't do something called MLI, Muslim Leadership Initiative? And I think Daniel Hartman, who took over after his father, he said, we'd love to teach. I don't think Muslims will come. And he says, if I can get 15 stupid masochistic halal guinea pigs to come for the first cohort of MLI, will you teach? He said, great. So he turned to me and he said, you know, you want to do this? Let's get 15 people. Let's go learn. And his whole thinking was there's a huge disconnect in America when it comes to several American Muslim communities and Jewish American communities who refer to themselves proudly as Zionist. Yes, the liberal Jews and liberal Zionists, there's a, you know, Muslims talk to them. They talk to JVP. But going back to Islamophobia and the research that we did, we saw that a lot of the money trail went back to some of these Jewish funding groups who were probably liberal and progressive on a whole bunch of issues. But when it came to national security and when it came to Israel-Palestine and when it came to the Muslim issue, they were, as you can guess, very right-wing, zero-sum.
What are some of the ones you're thinking of?
What we showed with the money was the Rosenwald Family Foundation. We saw Fairbrooks Foundation. We showed Donors Capital Fund, which we traced it to some Jewish funders. We showed it to Russell Berry Foundation. And, you know, my co-author was a Jewish American who's very sensitive about anti-Semitism. We just followed the money.
Who was your co-author?
Well, there were several co-authors, but one of them was Eli Clifton, who helped do the money trip.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and Eli, you know Eli. And so, you know, we looked at the publicly available funds. Racked up the numbers and we outed the funders. That's what we did. Some of them were right wing, some were for Jewish American. But when it came to this issue, and specifically, we see this happening again and again and again in philanthropy and business and media and government, that this issue, the issue of Israel and Palestine and how it is debated or lack of debate and conversation, inspires a zero sum absolutist mindset in some of our mutual communities, which I thought, seeing the trend in America several years ago, the trend of the rise of white nationalism, I thought it's going to screw us all. And I thought it inspires our worst angels. So I said, okay, I'm going for the sake of America, not for the sake of Palestine, or it's not called the PLI or ALI, Arab Leadership Institute, MLI. So we went, you know, both sides were like, we've never done this before. To their credit, Shalom Hartman Institute, which is against BDS, as you can imagine, and we can talk about BDS if you want.
Meaning boycott, divestment, sanctions, the idea of boycotting Israel to put political pressure on them.
Yeah, and because they're a proudly Zionist entity with a footprint in Jerusalem, obviously they're against BDS. And guess what? One of the funding groups that I mentioned, Russell Berry Foundation, guess who sits on the board of Shalom Hartman Institute? Angelica Berry, who runs the foundation after her husband's death. So okay. They looked at the roster of 15 Muslims and they said, there's two people that we say no to. Abdullah Antepli, the guy who started it because of his past anti-Semitism, and this guy, Wajahat Ali, because this guy freaking outed us in Fear Inc. To Abdullah's credit, he said, my team or no team. And to Shalom Hartman's credit, the second day we were there, they said, 90 minutes, you can address all of our scholars, talk about Islam in America, and we're going to print and send Fear Inc. to everyone. I said exactly what I had to say. I don't change mince words. And then afterwards, the funny thing I'll say is this, is two people came up to me, leading scholars, and said the following. I didn't know Muslims could be funny. I'm like, why? And they're like, we just thought Muslims were very like, I'm like, constipated? No, serious. And then the other most, and another Jewish scholar said, you know, when it was Muslim Leadership Initiative, we thought all of you Muslim leaders would be like Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran. And I'm like, damn, the bar is really low. And so we engaged in this educational learning. We did 2 weeks in Israel, and to the credit of Abdullah, we also went to the West Bank, occupied territories, Hebron, Ramallah, Jenin. And then we came back and continued the study. I was part of the program. And when word spread about this program, which I thought was a nothing burger, right? Like, we just went as a test to see if it will work or not. But word spread, and some Muslim American activists and pro-Palestinian activists were so unnerved by a few of us breaking BDS, which I never signed up to, that they did preemptive boycotts. So these preemptive boycotts have been happening, Bob, for the last 3 years, like boycotts, several boycotts.
Boycotts of what or who?
MLI. So all the participants in MLI.
Wait, what is MLI?
Muslim Leadership Initiative. The exchange, the
That's
engagement.
That's the Hartman thing.
Yeah, yeah. So they were.
So they would have been fine with MLI if it hadn't taken people into Israel. Is that it?
Some say that, but most of them say, to be fair, most say you engage with Zionist Jews. And don't engage with Zionism and Zionist Jews because it's normalization. And don't break BDS. And then conspiracy theories. Speaking about Islamophobia industry, I get hit from the right wing because they're convinced, like you said, that I'm part of the right-wing Muslim Brotherhood. Some of these activists are convinced that we came back as what was one article? A Zionist faith-washing Trojan horses. So we were collected and indoctrinated and sent back to America to break BDS. And so they had that conclusion and worked backwards with the facts.
Okay, let me interject. There's one other thing I came across. Like I said, I'm not an adequate stand-in for your critics, but I did a little Googling. And if you Google your name, like today, one of the top rankings will be a thing that I think she's a fellow. You are a Pakistani or a Pakistani descent.
Yes.
And she says it's a letter to you that appeared on MondaWise. Her name is Malia Khan.
Right.
She says, like you, I'm a Pakistani Muslim. Did you read this?
Yes, I did.
So one of her issues, just as long as we're talking about the Hartman Institute, is the Hartman Institute itself. I mean, she says that what they do is it's a one-sided exchange to teach emerging Muslim leaders about Israel and Zionism. It presumes Muslims are the ones who need to learn from Jews on this topic. So she's arguing that theirs is not like a symmetrical, you know, understanding kind of program, I guess.
Yeah, what was amusing to me about that article is a person who hasn't talked to me, a person who hasn't done MLI, a person who hasn't engaged in the program, somehow has amazing Professor Xavier-like wisdom as to the intentions and motivations of not only the participants but also the SHI faculty. And they presume the worst conspiratorial intentions upon all people. And I got knocked, Bob, which was interesting. There was like a lot of South Asian racism that came out, that who are you as a brown Pakistani to speak on this issue? You have no expertise. But I've been writing about this issue for a long time. I haven't said I'm an expert. No one ever doubted my expertise or brought up my ethnicity when I was saying exactly what they wanted me to say on this issue. Case in point,
the issue was that you're not Arab?
Well, some people who dislike my Atlantic piece are saying, who's this non-Arab talking? Only Arabs and Israelis can talk about it. And then some people said he's not an expert. And then they even just to cut me down further, said he's not even a reporter or a journalist. He's a pundit. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I actually went and reported. And so I'm amused because the same critics who levied that against me are promoting this lady's, Maliha's piece. And her claim to standing, she's a Pakistani woman married to a Jewish man. I digress. But the whole take is talk to the participants of MLI. We actually went through the program. And if we came back as Zionists and, you know, pro-Israel Hasbara propagandists, why is it that in our Facebook posts and our tweets and our articles, we are very staunchly anti-occupation and not Zionists? If Shalom Hartman Institute was this nefarious Zionist cabal doing Hasbara on us, they failed miserably, miserably. And it shows you, and I'm glad you started with the Islamophobia industry, because some of the very similar conspiracy theories that people have about Muslims, how they paint us as a monolith and purport onto us these very nefarious agendas, unfortunately, within our communities, I've seen people who would be embarrassed if you ever call them anti-Semitic. Like, I'm not anti-Semitic, but the way they talk about Jews and Zionist Jews is troubling and anti-Semitic.
Now, there is there are a couple of things here. One immediate thing on the issue of your being South Asian, I'm wondering if you got – there's a related critique that I'm wondering if you heard, because this kind of occurred to me when I saw the framing of the Atlantic piece.
Yeah.
Which is that it's like a Muslim goes to whatever is the kind of thing. A Muslim goes to Israel and investigates. Yeah. And it had occurred to me that, you know, on the right in Israel, there is a preference for framing this as an Israel, as Israelis versus Muslims, as opposed to Israelis versus Arabs.
Yeah.
And I think one reason for that preference is they'd rather not that American Christians not know that there are Palestinian Christians who are not happy about the occupation. In fact, as it happens, what was the 50th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's shooting? You know, it was like yesterday or something as we tape. And, you know, Sirhan, who killed him, was Palestinian, said he did it because of Kennedy's position on Israel. And he was Christian. Sirhan was a Palestinian Christian. And so there is, I don't know if you heard this, but there is a preference on the right for framing this. And this has kind of changed. It used to be, like, there was a book maybe 20 years ago by a guy named David Shipler that I think won the Pulitzer Prize. It was called Arab and Jew. And that's the way it was framed more, as Arabs and Jews. Yeah. And now the other reason I think there's a preference for this framing is that then you can kind of try to convince America that, like, we're all in this together. You know, it was Muslims that attacked you on 9/11, right? Well, Muslims are our problem. It's these crazy Muslims. So I think for various reasons, there's a preference for that kind of framing. And I'm wondering if anybody complain about that?
So that's good. So we discussed the first critique, which was engaging with Zionism or humanizing or normalizing. The second critique is, why did you choose this frame, Muslim among the settlers? And I don't disagree with people who say that the exclusivist framing as a religious issue is deeply problematic. I don't agree with I don't think it is a purely religious issue, because what it does is, to me, it's a very nihilistic extremist position taken by not only Jews, Muslims, but also some Zionist Christians that says, end of time scenario, we always hate each other, there's only one way out, there's no political solution to a political problem. That being said, you see the fallout now, and some people critique me for saying Palestine is only a political issue and religious communities don't have a claim to it. It is a political issue with a political solution. Well, guess what? Guess what some Muslims and Jews and Christians said in response to that, in light of the article? What do you mean? Of course Palestine is a religious issue. It's primarily a religious issue. And so now you have this conflict here where some people are saying, how dare you say Palestine is only a secular issue? It is part of our deen, our akhidah, our creed. And then you have Christian Zionists saying, which is the biggest Zionist group in America, is Christians United for Israel, it is primarily a religious issue because we want the end of times to come. You know, the precondition is Jews have to return to Jerusalem and control it for the coming of the Messiah. And then, as you said, some religious settlers primarily see this as a religious issue as well. For me, this was just one framing, not the only framing, and one take, not the only take. And I think it's a jumble. I think it's a political issue. I think it's a human rights issue. I think it's a social justice issue. I think it's an international law issue. I think it's an occupation issue. And this is where I disagree with those who are just nationalists. It is also a religious issue. To not include the religious framing takes away, I think, a large part of how religion has been used and abused in furtherance of ideologies and how it frames the issue for some communities. And that's my critique with the nationalists who say there's no religious component or it's purely a nationalist issue. I say everything you said I agree with, and it's also a religious issue. And so this was just one story, one frame, one report. But Bob, when it comes to this story, as you can imagine, everything is contested, even word space, even framing, even bones in the ground. So some people from all sides said the frame should have been X. You chose Y. How come you didn't go to Gaza? How come you didn't talk to Palestinian Christians? How come you didn't go to Haifa? How come you didn't do X, Y, and Z? And all I say is This is one story about one reporter who went and talked to the settlers, primarily in the West Bank, and it's called A Muslim Among the Settlers, specifically tackling this frame. That's it.
Okay. The I mean, as long as we're using the Malia Khan text as a stand-in for your critics, the another thing she brought up that I think is inevitably part of the context for this, you know, she mentions, she says, okay, you did this Hartman thing, then you magically gained access to The Atlantic, a publication run by a former IDF prison guard, IDF being Israeli Defense Force. She's referring, of course, to Jeffrey Goldberg, yeah, who is kind of notorious on the left, is thought of by some as kind of an apologist for the occupation. I mean, yeah. Roger Cohen, you know, the New York Times columnist, yeah, years ago, referred to him in the New York Times, actually, as referred to Goldberg as, quote, Bibi's faithful stenographer. Yeah. I think in a different context, I think that was about some other talking points not related to Israel-Palestine per se that Bibi was trying to get out and in Cohen's view, used Goldberg to do it. But, you know, he has written a lot about Israel. He cares a lot about Israel. He did, yeah, serve in the, I gather, the Israeli army. You know, he's going to pay a lot of attention to the framing of stories about Israel that appear in The Atlantic.
Of course.
He approved of the framing. Is that – how big a part of that – do you think – how big a part of the controversy is that? And does it give you pause?
It's part of the controversy, but what gives me pause is how people readily dismiss all that The Atlantic has done and also how they're very comfortable promoting – which I think are some troubling anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that Jeffrey Goldberg sits on top of my head as a Zionist overlord. And they kind of forget that, you know, he's an editor of The Atlantic. The Atlantic also publishes Peter Beinart, who's also very critical of Israel and also promotes, you know, just like this, the critique of the Center for Security Policy and John Bolton. And you also had Abdullah Fayyad, who is a Palestinian Christian, who did the nationalist argument right after mine. And so that's what really concerns me is this, and it goes back to 5 years ago also, is that somehow I have lost my critical thinking. Jews are way smarter than me. They're two steps ahead. They're so cunning that I went in and engaged with Jews and somehow lost all of my mental faculties and critical abilities and was used as a vessel for their nefarious agenda. Now, suppose you want to agree with that and say Jeff has a nefarious agenda. Here's Jeff, who we all know is a lover of Israel, who has gotten a lot of heat for his position in Israel. And he also gets it from the Jewish right for supporting Obama, the Iran deal, and being critical of the settlements. Yeah. He sent me...
I mean, I would say he pretty reluctantly supported the Iran deal, but at the end...
But
he
did, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm not going to be an apologist for Jeff's, yeah, position. I disagree with Jeff a lot. Iraq war positions, I disagree with him. I disagree with his position on Israel, and he knows that. So Jeff sent me and then allowed me to come back and basically end on a one-state solution, which is in the pages of The Atlantic, which for anyone who follows liberal Zionists or any Zionists, for many of them, it's like a dagger in the heart because for them, it is the end of Israel. Most overwhelming majority of people who read the piece who don't have, you know, a stake in it, if you could say, who are not so up close to it, said the settlements look bad. The settlers look kind of crazy. Palestinians are getting screwed. Huh. So here's Jeff, who sends a Muslim guy with a reputation for being anti-occupation, anti-Zionist, pro-Palestinian, gives me 8,000 words in The Atlantic and the magazine feature and the documentary where the settlers look, let's be honest, kind of nutty. Palestinians look like they're getting completely screwed because they are. And I end on a one-state solution. And I say the settlers' redemption of the land has made the land into a golden calf where Jewish morality, democracy, and liberalism will not be able to touch it. And then to cap it off, I get a 17-minute debate on Morning Joe. I didn't know it would be a debate, where I literally double down on my position, take on Joe and Barry Weiss, hard right Zionist, and I go on Joy's show on MSNBC, where I literally say if Israel continues on its path, it will end on apartheid.
So yeah, so in On Morning Joe, you were debating both Barry Weiss and Joe himself. Is he's like a hardcore Zionist?
The funny thing was, I was supposed to have a 5-minute conversation with Mika, and she really liked the piece. And then the next thing, I swear to God, I had no idea there'd be a debate. I see Barry in the makeup chair. I'm like, Barry, what are you doing here? He goes, I'm debating you. I'm like, glad no one told me. 90 minutes of sleep. I go in there. I talk about my piece. Now me and Barry are debating. Joe is in the corner just drinking coffee. I think he thought, you know, Mika would take this segment for 5 minutes. I think I got the upper hand on Barry throughout the entire debate. So then he comes in. He steps in. And now it becomes 2-on-1. I recommend all people seeing this. And Mika just goes quiet. And then this 5-minute segment, which was supposed to be at the piece, now becomes a 17-minute debate, me versus Barry and Joe. And then Joe openly says on the piece, you know, Mika criticizes me sometimes for being too pro-Israel. And he comes on and says essentially, and I said this on air, I'm like, wow, I'm listening to all the AIPAC talking points. And I held my ground. And, you know, for all the people like, what's his name, Maliha and all the others who think this is my opportunity to sell out, Bob, you know, Morning Joe is the show that a lot of the influential politicians and partisan folks and even the White House watch. I had 17 minutes to sell out. This was my moment. This was my Willy Wonka golden ticket to sell out and, you know, ascend the ladder. Watch the show. At the end, Joe and Barry agree with my positions and points. And Barry told me right after the debate ended, you got me. You won. If I really was a sellout, why wouldn't I just agree with her and her talking?
Well, there are some people who would say that's a warning sign if she says that to you. But,
no, but
I will
she conceded. She conceded I won. She goes, you got me.
There's a funny moment, by the way. Years and years ago, before Joe and Mika were at least officially an item, where Mika's father, Zbig, is on the show, and Israel comes up, and Joe says some stuff, and Zbig, who, of course, was Carter's national security advisor, just says, you are so stupid, man. Right. I mean, he is insulting. It's like, you are so naive and uninformed. And it's funny, because Mika was right there, and it's like her dad giving her...
Mika knows what's up. And Mika kept looking at me. That's the funny thing is, watch the debate. Mika looks at me, and you know when you look at someone, and they just like, I got you. I understand. I'm with you. Right now, I just got to let this guy talk. Mm-hmm. So the whole time I was saying what I was saying, you could tell that she was – I don't want to put words in her mouth. She seemed to agree with me. She seemed to get it. So Joe stepped in and admits on air, Mika tells me I'm sometimes pro-Israel. And he had Barry and Joe versus me. And if you really think I came out as a shill for Zionism in Jeffrey Goldberg's position, read the article, watch the debate, think for yourself.
Okay, so you talked about the article, how you ended – I want to read the last paragraph because it did strike me as a little as more or less. Well, I would say the article itself struck me. It didn't explicitly allocate blame. It did strike me as pretty symmetrical in the implicit allocation of blame. In other words, there are problems on both sides. And I think that comes through in the final paragraph. So let me just read it.
Sure.
You write, two things stand in the way of actual peace. And by the way, I'm not against symmetrical allocations of blame necessarily. I'm just talking about how it have been received by your critics. Anyway, two things stand in the way of actual peace. The first is the yearning of some Palestinians for all the Jews to leave. Israelis are not going to make peace with someone who tells them that their leaving is a condition for such a peace. But the second problem, perhaps the even bigger problem, is the settlements and the exclusivist attitude that motivates the people who live in them. A two-state solution is theoretically the best in a basket of bad solutions. But given the dismal realities on the ground, what might be better, alas, is a one-state solution that absorbs all the Palestinians as citizens of Israel and gives everyone an equal vote and equal rights. Ironically, this might be the only thing that many of the most hardline settlers and many of the most unbending Palestinians agree on. So you are ending on a note of a kind of a one-state a version of one-state solution, which certainly most Israelis would not accept. You know, you're also open to a two-state solution, but it's true you end on that note. Would you was there an explicit criticism that you are fine with a two-state solution? In other words, were all the critics one-staters, and was an explicit criticism that you seem to blame Palestinians as much as Israelis?
For some Palestinians, you said you made it seem so equal by making us look crazy and making them look more enlightened, and you know, it's their fault; they're the ones occupying us. And what I would say is, with this piece in particular, you can pick and choose and hate read certain lines, but I would ask you to read in the context, because a few lines before I said Palestinians need the right to self-determination and respect something that has not been afforded to them either by Israel or, let's be honest, fellow Arab countries. I'll give you one example, Saudi Arabia. Let's listen to the words of MBS just recently, just throwing him under the bus. I also mentioned the brutal occupation. And what I also did very deliberately, and this was a strategy I did, because I upfront in the piece say, this is my bias. This is where I'm coming from. But the majority of the piece, I said, I'm going to try my best to go as a reporter and storyteller and not use sentimental language. What I did instead was I painted the story and the context, the facts, the details that I saw. And for the overwhelming majority of people who read it, they said, Palestinians are getting screwed, because they are. Refugee camps, right? The ones who are right abutted to the settlements. They're, you know, the people in Hebron, which is like apartheid conditions. And so for most people, really, and this is why I feel vindicated, even though I don't think I should feel vindicated, was they're like, the scenes that I painted stuck with them. The scene of the woman and her family who are stuck in Hebron, surrounded by three sides of the settlement. Her son, who longs to play in the basketball court that's connected to their home, but that basketball court is reserved only for the Jewish kid whose friend is the IDF soldier, right? The fact that you're in a refugee camp right next to a beautiful settlement, there's families there for four decades, they don't get water, but guess what? The settlers do. The fact that there's Noam Cohen, who built an unauthorized outpost, which is authorized because nothing's really unauthorized, in the middle of the desert, is living his dream, and he openly says to me, we get everything. I get the school bus. I get infrastructure. Even how about the Wi-Fi? He said, even the Wi-Fi is pretty good. And so enough of these scenes were painted where most of the people, Bob, who read it said, settlements look oppressive. The settlers sound kind of nutty. Palestinians are being oppressed. But for both sides, I hate saying both sides because there are many sides, some Jewish Americans were like, where were the moderate settlers? And then they said, you were an apologist for Hamas. They're rejectionists. How can we interview more Hamas members? And then from some of the Palestinians, they're just so afraid, because I understand why, because they're robbed oftentimes of their own narrative in space on mainstream television. They said, why didn't you go talk to the moderate Palestinians who are in, say, Jerusalem? And I said, in this particular story, in this particular framing, it was a Muslim among the settlers, but I thought it was important to show the voices of Palestinians who were most affected by the settlements. And unfortunately, they are the most oppressed. And I didn't make a judgment call on this as much as I could. I mean, mostly I stayed away from it, but it's up to you to decide whether or not some of the extreme things that the Palestinians said in this piece, are they rationalized to say it? Meaning, if you were in that similar condition, would you embrace your Israeli settler with open arms? I don't know. But this act of rejectionism that does exist within certain Palestinian circles, whether it's legitimate or not, just to understand the fears of Israelis. I'm not saying it's right. To them, it's like, listen, and the ones who I've talked to openly, I'm like, you have a boot on the neck of Palestinians. And you realize the settlement and the occupation is that boot. And the more and more you put that boot on their neck, the more and more you're going to be a pariah in the international community. You're going to give up Jewish morality. International human rights is going to be against you. And they say, yes, we might lose our soul. But if we remove the boot, what will come in its place? We're afraid that Islamic Jihad and Hamas is going to come into this place. And then you're asking us to give self-determination and rights to the people who want to kill us. So essentially what they think in their mindset is they've created a catch-22 for themselves. Right. And if it's a zero-sum game for them, unfortunately, many of them are comfortable keeping the boot on the neck.
Yeah. Well, do you know Daniel Seideman?
I know of him. I don't know.
Okay. So he is a certainly left of center Israeli activist, who I guess is a two-stater, but very much against the occupation and the ongoing, subtle colonization of East Jerusalem.
Unsettled colonization.
What's that?
I would say. Unsettled. There are 300,000 settlers in East Jerusalem. It's considered occupied territory. It's very unsettled.
Yeah. And anyway, he uses the actual – apparently Thomas Jefferson said about slavery that it's like holding a wolf by the ears. You're afraid to keep holding on and you're afraid to let go.
There you go.
That's the idea. I also want to fill in a little background for people who don't know the terminology. When you referred to an outpost as distinct from a settlement, settlements are legal under Israeli law, although by most reckonings illegal under international law, whereas outposts are technically illegal under Israeli law as well as international law, But as you say, the fact is that there is an implicit toleration of them for the most part. I mean, every once in a while, I think, at least under some prime ministers, every once in a while, they make a show of going and dismantling some outposts. But by and large, they're like, if you see like a few trailers on a hilltop or something, that is an outpost. And I think these things sometimes evolve into settlements. But anyway,
yeah, you're right. Absolutely right. And there's about 100 now unauthorized outposts, which essentially have been spreading.
Yeah. Which leads to, I mean, I don't see, it's hard to see a glimmer of hope here. It seems to me, and you know, you interviewed Gershom Gorenberg, the Israeli, again, left of center, two-state.
Proudly Zionist.
Yeah, well, I mean, technically anyone who supports a two-state solution is a Zionist, at least in the sense of being willing to accept Zionism. I mean, yeah. Because that would be one of those states would be a Zionist state.
Yeah, the 1949
and it may be that that's one reason you got blowback, because at the end you say, look, two-state would be fine. And maybe in some people's eyes that makes you a Zionist or a countenancer of Zionism.
It does in some eyes. They want it all. Some people, they want it all. Yeah.
Yeah, but Gershom, where was I going with this? I've had this conversation with him, and I've told him, going back years, I think it's too late for a two-state solution. And this gets him really upset.
Yeah, this gets a lot of people.
Because he's like, well, pessimism is a luxury you can't afford if you actually live here and so on. And you quote him. And you say that you wrote a star by this in your notebook when you wrote down what he said,
yeah.
Suggesting that maybe you think he's right and there's hope. But what he wrote is I've lived here for 40 years and nothing important that has happened was expected. In other words, you never know. Suddenly a two-state solution could be viable. It seems to me when you look at – well, for a couple of reasons. One is just the sheer settlement infrastructure. It's vast. It's expanding. No one talks anymore about a two-state solution that would actually involve the withdrawal of all the settlements. It's
right.
A question of how much land the settlers get to keep and what kinds of land swaps you might give the Palestinians. But the other thing is that when you look at, you know, of course, people can show you polls where some appreciable percentage of the Israeli population says they would support a two-state settlement. But when you start talking about details and look at the propositions that have been seriously considered, you know, at those rare moments when it seemed like maybe a breakthrough was possible, and you look at what the Israelis were preparing to offer, it has tended to be things like, okay, in this Palestinian state, they won't control their borders, they won't control their airspace, they can't have a military. Well, that's not a state the way most people define state. These are prerogatives of a state to control right. Their borders, their airspace, to have a military. And so if it took like an extraordinary moment of opportunity to generate even that kind of offer, and leave aside the very problematic question of what the Palestinians would be willing to, what compromises they'd be willing to make, which I think is not very clear, just because there's less in the way of an organized entity on the Palestinian side. I just don't see any hope at all for a two-state solution at this point. Do you think it's there is actual hope?
So that was what led me to conclude with the one-state solution, that a two-state solution is the best of bad options, but you need a political will for it. And look at Netanyahu's Likud party. Look at its own mission statement. Look at its own platform. They think the West Bank belongs to them. They are perfect. Look at the Knesset members openly saying, annexa, Judea and Samaria, it's all ours. So how do you blame Palestinians for a failure of a two-state solution that the governing party itself does not believe in, that Netanyahu himself does not believe in, right? No one talks about that in U.S. media. Also, like you said, the settlements are mushrooming. And for your listeners at home and your viewers who don't really know about this, think about Swiss cheese and all the holes in the Swiss cheese. Imagine the holes keep increasing and all that's left is a sliver of land. That's what's happening to the West Bank. That's what's happening in East Jerusalem. Now, another barbed middle finger in the eye of the peace solution, international community, international law, and Palestinians, the U.S. move, the embassy moved to Jerusalem. Most Palestinians held out hope that for their future state in this two-state mythical solution, their capital would be in East Jerusalem. Guess what? The United States of America just said, Jerusalem is unified. exactly the position of the hard right. So now you get that off the table. So what do you have? You have 400,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank. You have 300,000 settlers in East Jerusalem. You have 20,000 settlers in Golan Heights. And Sharon pulled out the settlers in Gaza in 2005, but it's an open-air prison.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it dismantled them, right? But still, they control everything. It's an open-air prison. Gazans are just screwed. And so one positive about that is if there's a will, there's a way. Sharon pulled out, what was it, nearly 12,000 settlers, gave them each like $200,000 compensation, dismantled the settlements. But at the same time, he didn't have the most beneficial motives. He wanted to stall the peace process. If Israel wanted to do it, and this is where Gershom said this and why I started, if there was a will, they could pull it off. They could dismantle the settlements. They can move all those Israeli settlers to what is the 1949 borders, the armistice line. And they could give Palestinians this pathetic, flimsy piece of land, which at the very least would give them self-determination, something. I don't think it's going to happen, Bob, like you.
Yeah.
So then I say, fine, you're effed. You created this mess, the occupation, the settlements. Israel says it's a beacon unto the world. That was the Zionist ideal. A beacon, a nation unto the world that would be a beacon for the whole world, right? Fine, be the beacon. Here's your test. You say you're a liberal democracy in the Middle East. Be that liberal democracy. Absorb the Palestinians, absorb the Druze, absorb the Christians, absorb the Muslims, give everyone equal rights, each person, one vote, and voila. Have at it. Be the beacon for the Middle East and the rest of the world. Show us how it's done. They won't do it because they're afraid they'll lose the what? Demographic majority, and Israel will cease being a Jewish majority state. And so the only outcome is it will slither along, more occupations, more settlements, the boot will be on the neck, and unfortunately, you will get an apartheid-like state. That's the only outcome.
Well, the alternative outcome is there's an even worse outcome, or I don't know if it's worse. It's different and bad. It's basically ethnic cleansing. You know, you talked to settlers, I think, who said they think the Palestinians should be relocated to Jordan, didn't you?
Noam Cohen, with one breath, the guy who looks like, I said he looks like Israeli Iggy Pop, who's like a modern-day Thoreau, who's created his utopia on top of a hill. Neve Erez, it's unauthorized outpost. In one breath, he literally talks about, he sounds like a John Lennon track, like the sequel to Imagine. We all get along, there'll be a future where there'll be no religion, everyone love, love, love. And I said, what about the Palestinians? Yeah, we might have to expel them. Is Jewish life worth more than a Palestinian life? Of course it is, yes. You know, I will fight. I've been in exile for 2,000 years. And you're like, wait, what? So you're right. Not only will it be apartheid, it might be cleansing. It might be, God forbid, if the really wrong person comes in genocide, it might be forced transfer. And then what has Israel become? It has become the worst version of itself. It has literally lost its soul to redeem the land. And is that the goal and vision and hope of Judaism and the Zionist ideal?
Yeah, it's not, I mean, even now, I mean, it's a very ugly situation. You went to Hebron, I've been to Hebron. You know, if there is a single place in the occupation that just looks like apartheid,
it's there.
That's it. Because there's a street that, like, if you're Jewish, you can walk down it. If you're Palestinian, you have to walk along this kind of rocky path above. And leave aside, I mean, obviously there are real differences between the whole apartheid system in South Africa and what's happening and the current situation structurally in the West Bank. But it's, you know, it's just every, you know, it's very bad. And
some would say maybe they've already lost their soul. That's what some people say. They say maybe, while you're being too generous, maybe Israel has already lost its soul. It lost its soul when it started occupying, and more it just slithers towards becoming Hyde.
Did you see the tomb of the who's the guy? Is it
Tomb of the Patriarchs?
This is near the Tomb of the Patriarchs, but the guy who slaughtered the Palestinians, was it Baruch Goldstein?
Yeah, Baruch Goldstein, the American Jewish settler physician who moved to Hebron.
Now, he is buried there. Did you see his?
I passed by it, but I've seen it before. It's become essentially a memorial to him.
Yeah, it's like a shrine. People bring flowers every day. He's like a hero.
He's a martyr.
Yeah.
And for those people who don't know, he almost 20 years ago, he walked in to the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron, opened fire, killed about 26 praying Muslims. injured dozens more, and then he was killed. You know, the mob attacked him and killed him, and he's seen as a hero now. The shrine, as Bob mentioned.
Obviously not by everyone, yeah. but there's enough of a – I mean, it's apparently considered a legitimate thing to bring flowers to his grave. It's not like there's a lot of peer group pressure against doing that, apparently.
And there's also Kahane Park, Mayor Kahane, another hard right criminal, part of a Jewish terrorist group who was shot and killed. And Kahane Park is right there. It's named after Mayor Kahane. Another hard-right American Jewish pro-settlement individual who inspired literally terrorism and violence against Palestinians and called for terrorism and violence. And so if these are your marchers and if these are your heroes, it does tell you something about some of the settlers. And here I'm trying to be a good reporter. Not all the settlers, but some of the settlers.
No, there are different kinds of settlements, first of all. As you said, they're basically lifestyle settlements where the Israeli government gives them financial incentives. It's, you know, it's an easy commute. It's a nice place to live, swimming pools, blah, blah, blah. They're not particularly zealous as people are in some settlements. So there's different kinds of not just settlers, but settlements.
Right.
You know, and I think something you say in the article, which I think is true, I think you say, you know, there is in Israel, there is genuine fear, partly going back to the second Intifada, which was very violent. Now, in my own view, it's the fear on balance is counterproductively exaggerated. But then again, I think that's true of fear in a lot of places, including in America. Fear tends to be counterproductively exaggerated. But it is certainly one thing that gets in the way of, for example, a two-state solution where you would just say, yeah, you get to have a military, you get control your borders and so on. That just scares Israelis.
Yeah, it's a lot. But I'm glad you mentioned it. It's all lopsided, right? One's occupier, one's occupied. I mean, you just have to go there and see for yourself. You go in Jerusalem and you look at the Jews living in Jerusalem. It's beautiful. It's gentrified. Cross the Chalandia checkpoint like we did in the piece, and even the air smells worse. I mean, it's completely disproportional. Look at what happened in Gaza, the March of Return, just a few weeks ago. Look at the casualties, 110 killed Palestinians, 15, I think, children, including press. How many Israelis died? Zero, because the Israelis were firing at them with military weapons behind sand embankments, and the Palestinians were behind a fence in an open-air prison, 20 to 40,000 civilians who were doing the March of Return protest, coinciding with the 70th anniversary of Israel, which is called the Great Catastrophe, the Nakba for Palestinians. And the United States, led by now a hard-right government, Donald Trump, who's ambassador to Israel, is a bankruptcy attorney, David Friedman, yeah, who is pro-settlements against the two-state peace process, who urged the move to Jerusalem, who is part of the controversial, who was co-president of the Americans for Beit El Settlements, yeah, and who has called J Street capos. Capos. He called fellow Jews capos, yeah, collaborators.
As Peter Beinart said when he was appointed ambassador, you'd have been better off randomly choosing a David Friedman from the Manhattan phone book.
Yeah. But that just goes to show you, look, that's what we're dealing with right now. And so I always have to be optimistic because I think nihilism is cheap and lazy. You always have to be optimistic. But you go there and you talk to people and you just report. Just go to Hebron and report. Suppose you couldn't care less about anything. Just go to Hebron and see with your own eyes and then talk to the settlers and talk to the Israeli government and look at the polls. And you're like, this is not going to end well.
Yeah. No, it doesn't seem to be. Now, and you mentioned the kind of the absence of political will. I've always thought that there is one thing that could intensify political will on the Israeli side to get some kind of solution, but there's a reason it doesn't happen. And what that is if Palestinians in the West Bank just started marching in mass and saying, okay, you want the whole land, fine, just let us vote. Now, there are reasons that's not politically viable in Palestine right now, and the main one is that is considered to do that. To say you want to vote in an Israeli election, since Israeli is a Zionist country and is the occupying country,
yeah,
is to normalize the occupation, to legitimize the occupation. So that apparently is one thing that gets in the way of that. If you did it, it would scare Israel to death because it would put tremendous intellectual pressure. I mean, most people, you know, like in America, they don't know whether Palestinians in West Bank are allowed to vote. They're not even aware that you have a large population, in effect, ruled by Israel that's not allowed to vote in Israeli elections. That would put huge pressure on Israel. It's never gotten off the ground, you know, for reasons that are understandable. But aside from that, I don't see any way. And that could, I think that would be more likely to lead to a two-state solution than to a one-state solution, because at the end of the day, Israelis are less afraid of even a generous two-state solution probably than they are of a one-state solution.
Yeah.
But that might at least lead to a more generous offer on the two-state front. In any event, barring that, I don't have any kind of scenario in mind where this works out well. Just a series of political events that lead this to work out well. I just don't see it.
I mean, look, Palestinians, when you talk to them and, you know, when you visit and talk to them, at the end of the day, most Palestinians there are not as hardline absolutist as some of their defenders, because they can't afford to be. And you've seen this with any conflict. The people who are in the conflict live in the gray area the most. They need to negotiate. They need to work with people. Some of the most absolutist hardliners are the people so far removed away living in suburban America with on their lazy boys tweeting and typing away. Most people there, they just want normalcy. They want to breathe. They want to have a chance at living a life with freedom and self-determination. They're so sick and tired of the occupation, right? They just said, just give us something that gets the boot off our neck. And this is where you also could use pressure from Arab nation states who have come together around the two-state solution again and again and again. Even Hamas, whether they're sincere or not, who cares? They even said at the beginning of this year that, fine, we'll acknowledge the 49 armistice line for Israel. The reason why Hamas wants to do this is because they're suffocated and isolated, much like North Korea. They want to be seen as an international player. But you need that international will as well. And this is where we can shamelessly call out Arab nation states. Look at Saudi Arabia, buddy-buddy with Israel. Look at MBS, throws Palestinians under the bus.
That's Mohammed bin Salman, the heir apparent and crown prince in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Look at Egypt and Jordan. Why are Gaza Palestinians in Gaza choked off from the south? Because Egypt has a blockade. Egypt and Jordan just signed a $25 billion, I think, gas deal with Israel. Turkey, Erdogan comes in as the Khalif of Muslims, and right after this March of Return thing, you know, at the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, 57 Muslim-majority states, he spoke out. And again, he used religious language. So the people who said nationalism, he said this is an affront to Muslim countries. Deliberately said that because he wants to be seen as the vanguard for Muslim nations.
And America.
But he buys weapons from Israel.
America plays a kind of a role here because they buy the acquiescence of especially the Arab states that don't have oil like Jordan and Egypt that are more dependent on financial support from the outside. You know, America has traditionally kept them from becoming a thorn in Israel's side in any significant way.
U.S. is a huge, I mean, sometimes a friend's job is to intervene, not to enable. Sometimes a friend's job is to say you're going off the rails. Let me give you some tough love. And the reason why in the international world, international community, and many Muslim majority countries, why United States gets criticized is precisely because of what people say is an unconditional support of Israel. And the reason why this hurts all of us is it also helps extremism. ISIS and Al-Qaeda aren't stupid. Look at their top 10 grievances they always use for propaganda. Israel-Palestine.
Yeah. So back to the original, the controversy that got my attention about this. How do things stand there? In terms of you and the Islamic Society of North America, which I gather as the conference approached, got pressure from various groups that wanted you disinvited or something. And have you had dialogue with any of your most severe critics? I mean, you can have it here if you want. We're open.
So what happened was the missing link for your viewers is all this happened, and a week ago, I was invited to ISNA. ISNA is one of the largest, oldest American Muslim organizations that claims to represent 4 million American Muslims.
What does it stand for? What's the acronym?
Islamic Society of North America.
Every year
they do a big conference. That's their big thing, Labor Day, the big conference. They have been following this controversy. They've asked me to do 3 fundraisers for them in the past year. I spoke at them. Even after this controversy with the MLI, they had no problem. They invited me. I did this tweet about taking a dump, which in context, my critics, and especially some of the MLI critics, use as pretext to see why are you inviting him.
Maybe we should elaborate. You're trying to explain that the phrase Allahu Akbar, which means God is great, is not only uttered by people who have just who are about to detonate a suicide bomb.
Yeah, I said it's so common. Allahu Akbar means God is greatest. Muslims use it in prayer, and it's also seen as an expression we just use all the time to express gratitude. So when the Warriors win, I say Allahu Akbar. When my mom makes awesome biryani, I'm like, Allahu Akbar, mom made biryani today. And I said, even after taking a giant dump, I've said Allahu Akbar. Yeah,
well, in retrospect, maybe that was a bridge too far. But for a few,
it was a bridge too far. But the overwhelming majority of people, as I was tweeting this because Allahu Akbar was trending, most people said, honestly, atheists were like, Allahu Akbar used to terrify me. It makes sense. Even I've said God is great.
Yeah.
Most Muslims are like,
the dump imagery was what did it for him, huh? The Warriors didn't. Your mom didn't, but
yeah. But so for some of the hard right, the dump imagery, they spent 2 days obsessed with this tweet. All this other stuff is happening. The Muslim ban and Trump is like ending the diversity lottery program. But the dump tweet, and it shows you the hard right who want to control religiosity in all religions. And then the group that was after me for 4 years for engaging with Zionists then teamed up like Voltron with this group and added more pressure. This was in October. But to ISNA's credit, ISNA still invited me just in Austin a couple of months ago. This Atlantic article came out, and they're doing their conference now in Houston for the first time, not in Chicago. And one of the leaders of ISNA said one of the leading kind of conservative influencers of Houston has openly called for a boycott of you based on all this stuff that you've done, the dump tweet and also the Zionism, and also I'm not a Zionist, but engaging with Zionists and MLI. And listen, we're afraid for ticket sales and attendance. And I'm with you. I get it. You're 5 years ahead of the community. We have to drag some of the community members along, but I'm afraid that people won't come. And I said very calmly, I gamed this out with them. I said, you're taking a short-term win for a long-term loss. If you let absolutists in the community, any community, hijack you and chokehold you, they win. See what happened to the Republican Party and the Tea Party. This is a long-term loss. No one cares about this stuff. Most people come to ISNA to get a spouse for their daughter or their son. They'll pay $6 for a samosa. They'll listen to some speeches. They'll go home. No one cares. Don't get hijacked by absolutists. They said, okay, well, think about it. I said, whatever you do, though, you're going to have to tell me based on principle why you disinvite me. And they tried to get me to like disinvite myself. I said, absolutely not. You've invited me 3 times before. I've come every year. Obviously, you have no problem with me. You put my name on the freaking covers. You promoted it. Take a stand. The letter came out. You read the letter. The letter was very troubling to many Muslims because it made Palestine into a religious issue next to creed. And then said the entire ummah, Muslim communities, is unified around Palestine. Really? One state? Two state? Religious issue? Secular issue? BDS? Are they really unified? And then said, based on your recent work with Jihad, we have to disinvite you. What recent work? Is it engaging with Zionists with MLI? Is it the article? No one knows. And then I decided, and the final thing
dump tweet. Don't forget dump tweet is a candidate.
Oh, and the dump tweet. The dump tweet. The dump tweet was very critical. They also the dump tweet. Thank you so much. And then I decided, because I told them I would respond publicly, which is why they put it on letterhead and signed it and made it professional, I responded. And it wasn't less to do about me, Bob, and more to do what I see as the absolutist litmus tests that are created around political issues that force inclusion or exclusion, and specifically caving into absolutists, both on religious and political terms, for a body that claims to represent the diverse Muslims of America. I think this trend that we're witnessing in American politics with the Republican Party, even some on the left, we're witnessing within Muslim communities, I think it's a disease and a cancer. And as a result of that piece, you'll be surprised, a lot of people were really horrified by ISNA's position, even within ISNA, I should mention. And it's causing a lot of soul searching. And I said, if this is your position and you're an American organization, you can't be two-faced. Say what you mean what you say with your Jewish faith partners, Christian partners, media, stand firm. And if this is your position, stand firm with American Muslim communities who will be horrified that you are making Palestine into a creedal religious issue with very set rules. And God forbid, if you disagree like I do, I agree with most of it, but if I disagree, what happens? Two things happen. I get boycotted, or Bob, if it's a creedal issue, does that mean I'm stepping outside of Islam?
So are there any signs of rapprochement? I mean, you said there's soul searching within ISNA, and it sounds like there are people in ISNA who might want to, build some bridges or something, but there's nothing going on in that.
I think people are trying to save face. I think a lot of people didn't agree with that letter. I think within our community, it's caused a very good conversation. 50% of people think I'm Voldemort. They think I've become an Islamophobe. They think I've sold out, sucking at the teat of Jewish power to ascend. After a week and a half of some of these horrible accusations and articles, a lot of other people are saying, wait, I know Waj. I might disagree with him on X, Y, and Z, but this is insane. I don't agree with this. And in the last 2 days, Bob, I've seen a shift where a lot of these people who went with the mob mentality, because all mobs are the same, right? People get terrified. They just go with whatever is popular. Now people are saying, I actually went and read the article. Who would have thought? People actually reading the article for themselves. And I don't agree with a lot of what's been said. So with ISNA, I think I'm glad because it's causing a conversation and debate. And a lot of people have been worried about this trend of absolutism, but no one wants to be the it guy who gets boycotted. Do you know what I'm saying? And so I'm not interested in being a martyr either, but my kind of public exercise of this is causing a lot of people to wake up and say, well, wait a minute, why are we caving into litmus tests? And can I think for myself? And should this be a religious issue? And can't people think for themselves? And so let's see how this plays out. I think let's give it 2 more weeks.
Okay. So are you in principle open to debating one of your detractors
in principle, sure. But at the same time, the reason why I don't debate a lot of Islamophobes is they make me prove negatives all the time. Prove you're not a radical member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Prove you are loyal to America. Engage in the condemnathon. And since I've been hit by all these sides, I see it as two sides of the same coin. It's the same strategy. And I think to myself, am I gaining anything from this conversation or this debate? Or am I just empowering people who really aren't interested in a conversation or debate? And the thing I'll end on is this. I've talked to a lot of these people for the past 5 years. Talk to me. Let's have a conversation. Let me tell you my intention. You know what the hardliners say? You have to renounce MLI and accept BDS or else.
And MLI is the Muslim Leadership Initiative done by the Hartman Institute.
And BDS is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions. And I have to accept it and their terminology and their framing or else. And when someone comes at me like that, I choose or else.
And their complaint about MLI is roughly what this woman, Malia Khan, said. I gathered that they think that it is that what the Hartman Institute wants to do is kind of give Muslims a more sympathetic understanding of Israel, but without doing anything symmetrical. That's apparently, I may be misrepresenting here, but
the main sin is BDS. The main sin, let's be honest. The main sin is you broke BDS, and for some people, BDS has become the sixth pillar of Islam. The second major sin is you're normalizing.
But if that's a complaint, then it's just technically it's just that you went to Israel to research this story. In your view, that's
no. You the main thing. I mean, the main thing really, if we have to be honest, is BDS calls for academic, cultural, economic.
Oh, I see. So you wouldn't be doing business with the Hartman Institute if you were respecting BDS. Is that it?
That's it.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, if we find someone who
let me wants, know. Let me know.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll come back.
We'll run by you if any names occur. I'll have to scan Twitter to see who your critics are. But thanks for taking the time. Anything you want to plug? I mean, there's still Fear Inc. You're apparently, which turned out to be apparently a roadmap to the current White House.
Yeah. I think people should read Fear Inc. I think people should read the Atlantic article. It's called The Muslim Among the Settlers. Think for yourself. See the documentary, which I didn't have final edit, but Daniel Lombroso did it. And read the critiques and read all my critics and read the piece for yourself.
We will link to the Atlantic piece and to your subsequent Atlantic piece about the controversy, as well as to the letter from Malia Khan or in Imanda Weiss. And for people who are watching this on YouTube or listening on the podcast, what I mean when I say we will link to it is at bloggingheads.tv at that URL. We'll have links that you can reach right directly into the video. So thank you, Waj. And
this was fun. This was good.
Yeah, well, good. And maybe you'll be back talking about this more with somebody else.
Let's do it, man.
Who knows? Okay. Take care.
Later.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.